Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here for our executive committee meeting. Just for the record, it's Monday, October 3rd, 2022. It's about 5 minutes after two, and we are going to convene our executive committee meeting. I'm going to ask for a roll call, please.
I will just note for you all that our microphones have been a little bit slow to turn on, so you may have to double click on the button on the base. Joel Flores. Present. Maria Marino.
Here.
Michael Napoleon.
Here.
Chelsea Reed.
Here.
Robert Weinroth.
I am here.
Thank you.
All right. We are all present and accounted for. Do we have any modifications to our agenda for today? No. Okay. I don't see a need to move the agenda, so we'll move right on to general public comments. Do we have any?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
All right, very good. So I'm going to look for comments from the members. I have really none at this point. Seeing none from the members, we're going to go on to our executive director's report. Ms. Nielsen?
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. Have a few updates for you, starting with unfortunate news that we had a hurricane, and I hope everyone stayed safe and your loved ones as well. But it happened to be right the week that we were doing our peer exchange with Austin, Texas. So we are looking for new dates, likely in spring of 2023, hopefully by April. But we'll be following up soon on those new dates to be able to go on that trip that we had to postpone. Also, we'll be advertising a request for proposals likely either today or tomorrow for our 2050 long-range transportation plan update. This is really exciting because it's a plan that we update every 5 years. It'll be about a two-year process with the goal to end by the end of next year, and with the goal to kick off in early 2023. The request for proposals will last until about the first week of November, and that will make us all go into a cone of silence, so not talking to any consultants about it or anything like that. But just wanted to give you that update. We're really excited to get that kicked off. Also, October is National Pedestrian Safety Month. There's a few events going on. Next week is Walk and Roll to School Day, National Walk and Roll to School Day. On Wednesday, we'll be joining the school district at Everglades Elementary School, which is actually in Commissioner McKinley's district, but we've reached out to her to see if she would like to join us. However, we do encourage everyone to reach out to your local schools. You can see what schools are participating in your area, or we can let you know to join them in walking to school on that day. And then the Florida Department of Transportation and the TPA are also celebrating Mobility Week on October 21st to the 28th. We're organizing a bicycle ride, but also I know the Board of County Commissioners is doing a proclamation tomorrow for that as well.
Sitting on my office.
So that's exciting to promote mobility options and raise awareness. On that note, in front of you, there is a new flyer that TPA PR staff created. We do have a lot of people knock on our door and ask us for where do they buy a pass to ride the bus or the train, or and different, sometimes different questions like that. So we created this brochure so that we can give it to them, but also help spread the word on the different mobility options. On the back is the contact information, websites for more information on ways to get around. So trying to raise awareness about that. And then the Florida Love to Ride Challenge kicks off right in during that week and lasts till November. Encourage your communities, your cities, your local businesses to participate in that. TPA has been a top performer for our business size in previous years, but other competitors have been the Village of Palm Springs and some of our local municipalities as well. So encourage you to get involved. Railvolution is a conference that we mentioned a couple times, but it's coming up. It's a national conference, moves around North America, and it happens to be happening in Miami, October 30th through November 2nd. It's all about transit-oriented development, transit, land use, and transportation, and it's going to be bringing a lot of national folks here to our region. Our region is a co-host of this event, so we're participating. If anyone would like to attend, please let us know. It starts on a Sunday evening and lasts till Wednesday. On the last day is a regional day, where there's a free workshop. The flyer on the right is a image of that workshop, but has several panels with different transportation leaders in South Florida, including a panel with the three chairs of the three MPOs, with Chair Weinroth speaking on that panel. Clinton Forbes will be speaking. David Deck will be speaking on moderating actually a panel that I'm on with the other MPO directors. So it'll be a great event. It's from 2 to 5 at the Miami Intercontinental Event Hotel, and it's free. We are about to kick off our fiscal year 23 grant application cycle at the end of this month after our board meeting. And that will be, we'll have a workshop for applicants on November 3rd. Also wanted to bring your attention, there's a Urban Land Institute Florida Summit happening in Miami in December with an elected officials workshop, free for elected officials, public sector, to discuss density and transportation. So if that's a topic of interest, I encourage you to attend. It's unfortunately, that date happens to be our executive committee meeting. However, there is going to be another one January 18th in Broward. So just a few things going up. And we're working diligently to schedule and organize mobile tours for our board and other interested parties to experience our transportation facilities here in our county. So stay tuned. We have several tours coming up. If you've never been to, I'm sure many of you have tried these, but we're trying to get more board members to experience and visit the transportation facilities we're planning for and talking about, including our airport, the Port of Palm Beach, Palm Tran, Tri-Rail, and hopefully the Boca Brightline station soon. Just wanted to give an update too on team building. We've been working on different events here at the TPA with staff. Team building trainings, as well as having staff cross train each other on the things that they're doing and other events. We went to the Flagler Museum. Surprisingly, a lot of folks hadn't been there, but to learn about the history of Flagler and trains in Florida, and been doing different events like that. So really appreciate staff's participation. Amanda actually organized the picture on the school's drive. So we had a great participation for that. And we had a dog meet and greet for those that wanted to bring their dog to work one day. I also wanted to give an update on our human resources. We did put out an RFP. We had a close that we didn't get enough applicants that met the criteria, followed the instructions. We're revising that, but in that process, we have learned that our legal counsel has a labor department that reviews and provides several of the services we were looking for. So they've been actually helping us reviewing our processes, updating our handbook for legality and other best practices. And so they're serving in that arm right now. We are still working on the consultant scope, revising it, but the need that we need has been reduced. Right now we are working with the federal government and the state on new guidelines that they've imposed on DBE and other contracting. So we're working on that, but we will be putting that out soon to have an HR consultant. In the meantime, we've kind of the human resources tasks that we needed, we're covering most of them.
Before we move on, let's talk about human resources. What are the costs right now as far as WIFE's handling HR for us?
So our legal counsel is about $250 an hour. Mm-hmm. And
whenever we ask them. And that's on an as-needed basis. It's not any sort of flat rate or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. We do have a contract with them, and we issue a work order if there's something specific. So for example, we found that they did do an audit and update our personnel handbook, which is an item on the agenda, but they noted several required legal trainings that we need to have as an agency, and they're able to provide that. They have staff to be able to provide those trainings. So that'll be a work order. We say we need these trainings, and they'll issue a work order for that under our existing contract.
I am assuming that, comparatively speaking, the cost of the law firm handling this function at this time is less than what you were seeing as far as the response to your previous RFP.
Yes, it is significantly less than the hourlier retention rate that we saw from when we researched that.
All right. Well, the question I guess we need to just talk about is whether we need to really be going forward with an RFP or whether this is sufficient to satisfy the needs of the agency at this point. I think we were all concerned that there needed to be some third party person or entity that someone could go to with a complaint rather than having to go straight up the line if they felt that there was an issue. And I think that this satisfies that. And again, $250 an hour is not cheap, but we're only paying for what we need. Mm-hmm. It's probably less expensive than an ongoing contract. Any thoughts? Hey, you're with us now.
I guess my question would be, do we actually, in our RFP, and I'm sorry, I haven't read it, do we figure a minimum of hours that we thought they would need to work and that Weiss could give us a comparison?
We identified the things that we needed, and they basically, the proposals that we saw was we need a retention rate to just be on call and an hourly rate whenever you do call us. But the one that we got was about $700 an hour and on top of the retention rate. So it was pretty
that's
pricey
ridiculous.
In that sense. Yeah.
So retention rate was what?
Matthew, do you recall the...
Not to put you on the spot, but you have an idea of what that came back like?
I want to say it was a couple $100,000 for a three-year
for a retainer?
Contract. Yeah, for like a three-year contract. So it was pretty pricey. That's the one that we got. And so that's why we were going to revise it, significantly scale it back and put it back out. But we, through this process, learned that the labor team from our legal counsel has many of the services that we're looking for, and we are so small that those services are available, and we provide that contact information to all staff if they need to call and seek support.
You have some input. Good afternoon. I just was checking. We had from 10 to 30 hours is what some of the proposals come back of proposed work in HR services on a weekly basis. And then, yeah, they did exceed $300,000.
The retention rate was running at what? Did you have that number?
Could you clarify what you mean by retention rate? Each month was over 7,000 a month.
7,000?
Yeah.
In addition to the 700 an hour for actual work to be done.
It's kind of a balance of the two. It was about 10 hours at 700 a month, kind of a arrangement.
All right. Vice Mayor or Mayor, sorry.
That's okay. Are there any other, so when you look at an HR RFP, it's more than just legal. Do you see any other holes that need filling or any liability that you as executive director or your staff would have to manage if having HR come in didn't happen?
I feel pretty confident with our general counsel now that I've learned that they have a labor team and staff that can handle these types of processes. And now that they're very familiar with our personal handbook and all of our processes that they're helping us walk through, what we do need to work on and work towards is the top right corner, the TP accounting payroll HR system, which is something that we had at the county where you'd log into a portal and you could see everything and put in your timesheets and all of that sort of thing. That's something that we actually need to work towards as a our next request for services. So that is something that we still need.
How is payroll done now?
You can just stay up there for a little bit, maybe.
Okay, I'll just stay here. So right now we use, is it working?
Not red yet. There you go.
Good.
So right now we use a combination of Microsoft Excel. There are certain requirements for a timesheet and how it's recorded that can be done in a simplistic way on Excel. You can do it on paper if you need to. Excel I can use to aggregate all the information that's necessary. So it is more of a manual labor intensive process right now. Getting the right accounting and payroll solution in place, it takes time. We've done some research on that. And
you broke it. Would QuickBooks be something that made more sense, something that would actually be able to put those hours into a formula and then create the payroll checks or ADP as a payroll service? I mean, what makes the most sense for an ongoing payroll procedure?
So forgive my smile. We started with ADP when we went independent. They didn't deliver quite the things that we needed them to in integrating. And we use QuickBooks as our accounting service. Mm-hmm. QuickBooks does have some accounting some timekeeping features. Again, there's some necessities in that two parties have to sign them. And then I still have to aggregate that data for our reimbursement invoices, which are all of that payroll data fits into. So on our last look at QuickBooks, it was all of the features that they have for timekeeping came up a little light. They may have made that more robust and in more recent days. There's, again, this is always advancing, this field. But we've been looking for something a little more cohesive.
What are you using for budgeting and for expense management as far as the software? Excel or?
It's largely Excel based that we're doing a lot of that. We use QuickBooks, and where we enter a lot of our accounting data is there. We use that for our auditing purposes for all of our financial efforts. But budgeting gets a little more interesting with a 2-year budget cycle. So we generally have used Excel tables and formatting.
Well, I mean, I had a small business before I had this job, and we used QuickBooks, and I found it to be, you know, effective for expense control, budgeting, payroll. And I'm wondering if that might not be a suitable answer. I just think Excel and sort of creating your own reporting is not as neat and may not even satisfy an internal auditor as far as having the proper controls on it.
So as far as it satisfying the internal controls requirement, it does.
Okay.
As far as using QuickBooks, again, there's two elements. One is timekeeping and one is payroll, where you actually execute the payments to the staff. We use QuickBooks payroll. The timekeeping segment, where we have to attribute staff hours to specific tasks, that breakdown has been more challenging to do because we do so on a loaded rate. So not just what their salary is, but the total cost to employ a person. It makes that a little more, it's made that more complex to track.
So it almost sounds like you're looking for a payroll system that a law office would use for managing, you know, the amount of time that you're putting on particular cases specific to here would be on particular projects or account numbers that you would establish.
That's actually absolutely right. And we've spoken with several large players in that field. We've been drafting that RFP or RFS to do that. We're stuck on this, these requirements that the state has put on us. Beginning July 1st, any federally assisted contract is required to comply with Florida's DBE reporting system. So we're trying to navigate that and say, yes, we need you to do this business. And then they say, well, what is this giant amount of red tape? We're not going to do that. So we have a meeting later this month with FDOT to try and navigate that better. But that's been our real holdup. We have several important procurements that we're working through. It's really the smaller size procurements that it's an issue. And once we can resolve that matter, then we can put it on the street. We can talk to these, again, like you said, law offices. It's very similar what we need.
Right.
It's just about we have to do the procurement in a compliant way, and then that they want to work with us that way.
Okay. Commissioner Marino, I didn't mean to cut you off. Were you done? Okay. Mayor Reed?
Thank you so much. That sounds like you guys have to juggle a lot of different balls and keep them up in the air for everyone to have everything covered from HR to payroll to if there's an issue between staff or otherwise. And so putting out the request for services for a company to come in, that's an umbrella that covers all of it, does make sense unless it doesn't financially for us, right? So because we're beholden to taxpayer dollars to pay for what we do here. So I think that it's something that am I hearing that we're no longer considering going forward with the request for services or
as of proposal? Prior to this meeting, we were still working on a much more refined and simple request, but I think that based on the results that we received and based on the information we've learned from our legal counsel that they are able to provide those services. Right. And because we have an existing contract with funds, if with a lot of funds, if we were to reach that near that top, then we can revisit that. But at this point, I'm not sure if we really need a third party to just handle that when we do have labor attorneys that ended up being more cost-efficient.
So the only hole, mm-hmm. like to my previous question, right now is payroll is
refining that and getting that platform for timekeeping, the ultimate platform for timekeeping and payroll that we want to move on to.
And so once all these systems are put in place, are they like replicable and easy to follow so that if you have more responsibilities come your way as time goes on, which seems to be the case with every job in the world, right? Especially yours, that it's easily. So when you talk about policies and procedures, I spent a lot of time in this and I've done tons of RFPs for having payroll companies in come into different businesses that we ran over the last 25 years. So this is not my first rodeo doing this, but my only concern is that if we're going to piecemeal it, which it sounds like we can, that it's replicable a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now and onward. So that if you're not the only person ever touching it and Valerie's not the only executive director ever touching it, that it is completely replicable. That's the only thing that we have to worry about.
Sure. So the hole that Valerie pointed out, that's really where it's easier access for staff to see the documents they filed for HR benefits and those things. We have within our system the ability to see that now. It's not as user friendly, and that's what we're going to improve. It's usually an included service when you have the accounting and payroll system. Like you can just, it's a repository there. It's simple. It's straightforward. So that fits there. And I just want to draw attention. It's actually the lower left hand quadrant. The HR consultant that we still have identified here is the conflict resolution and grievances. That's that third party that's not someone at the TPA that we don't have that yet. We have the attorney, which helped draft the original TPA handbook and has made these revisions, very qualified, can handle the legal aspects. We're trying to sort out that conflict resolution and grievances. Again, that's such a reduced area of responsibility now. It's, well, do you still want to do that contract? So we really looked at all the aspects of HR that we need and said, how are we handling these now? A lot of them we handle in finance. We have our health plan that covers some counseling. It's really that the missing piece right now is just that conflict resolution and grievances.
Which they mentioned that they have staff and additional staff to help with that. They do that for other people. So
let me ask you a question. Is there, what kind of reconciliation is there between this time management that you're doing to identify all the projects everybody's being credited for, and then the ultimate issuance of a paycheck? Are we dealing with two separate databases now, or are you taking that information that, again, I'm assuming is in an Excel spreadsheet, and then that's creating your payroll? I mean, explain to me what the checks and balances are in all this.
So we have three parties that are involved with payroll. We have an accounting consultant who's working with us right now. We send it over to him. The timesheets that are created and staff sign and their supervisors sign. So here's our timesheets, start preparing the payroll. We have an Excel record that's kept every week or every payroll cycle where we populate all of the benefits, salaries, all of the elements of payroll. And we use that to enter and verify what's in QuickBooks. So the external accountant enters that. And then our procurement and grants coordinator, she reviews his work, and then I verify it before I actually issue payment or release the payroll funds. So it's a three-step procedure to ensure that we've properly handled the payment, timekeeping, and all reimbursements that might happen during that pay cycle.
The actual paycheck, how is that being drawn? Are you typing it? Is it coming out of a software package? I mean, how is the actual paycheck being generated?
It's populated through QuickBooks, and it's a direct deposit to the staff member.
All right, so no one's getting a paper check at this point?
No.
Okay. Councilman Napione.
Yeah, just going back to the HR component, I mean, I understand what our council is saying, but I'd be surprised if they can serve the same function as an HR professional, because usually, I mean, I am at a law firm. We have a great labor and employment department, but they are not set up to handle the day-to-day HR issues that come up in any small business. So, you know, I don't know what they've said they can do. Maybe they can do it. Maybe they're set up differently, but I'd be surprised that they can do more than just, you know, the employee handbooks and those types of issues. Sure, they can do that. But the day-to-day personnel issues that come up, that's when you usually want to have someone either who's here full-time, which we don't need, or someone outsourced, that's their job. So I'd like to see what the pricing is for that, because I'd be surprised if any law firm could do efficiently what a dedicated HR company could do.
And I believe they're on the line.
Yes, we do have Paul is joining us virtually.
Is Milton also?
I haven't seen Milton join.
Okay.
No.
Maybe Paul, would you like to chime in on that? I know that.
Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. Your microphone is muted.
I'm just looking at this number here. $18,000 for.
Yes, we can hear you.
Contract.
Okay. Do anything. Yeah, I think that's going to be a Milton question, because Milton and his labor team are going to be the ones that would respond to your labor. Your labor stuff on a day-to-day basis. And if they say they can do it, they can do it.
We do have one phone number calling in that potentially is Milton. We've allowed that phone number to talk. If Milton, if that is you, feel free to unmute and chime in.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, this is Milton Collins. Good afternoon, everyone. My labor and employment group can handle most of the human resources related matters. I do concede that some of the day-to-day administrative work, that is something that we probably wouldn't do. It probably wouldn't be cost effective. And from what I understand, the executive director does have someone in-house that can handle some of the day-to-day administrative work. But anything more high level, anything more sophisticated, we are more than capable to handle anything from reviewing contracts, policies, procedures, drafting, handling complaints, handling any sort of discrimination matters. We can certainly handle that, no problem.
Thanks, Milton. And in terms of on the screen, we have the two items that we still had kind of identified for a potential separate HR consultant were conflict resolution and grievances. Under our current health plan, we obviously have counselors that folks can call for personal matters, but in terms of an actual intervention, conflict resolution, a complaint and a grievance, those are the two items that we have identified. Is that something, I think the question is whether general counsel's labor team, if that's something that can be handled.
Milton?
Dear Ms. Nielsen, I think one of the issues that we've come across is a lot of the companies out there, you know, they're really not willing to do this very limited scope of services. And that's why, you know, we've offered our services to handle some of the more substantive matters concerning labor and employment and human resources. But to the extent that we can find an entity that will do payroll and some of the conflict resolution items that Ms. Nielsen mentioned, by all means, we should proceed with that.
Thank you, Milton. Commissioner?
What's sort of a, I don't know. Why would we not have asked the law firm before we did this if they were able to do this and when they knew that the RFP was going out?
I can answer that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, members, I think the reason for that is it's a normal assumption that as soon as you get lawyers involved, it's going to be more expensive than than what you are going to get by going out on the private market to non-attorneys. And frankly, I have to tell you, I'm somewhat surprised that we're able to do this at a more competitive rate. What I was going to say to you is we're not campaigning to do this service for you, but you know, if we can do it better and give you a better price than what you're going to get in the private market, then you know we're there for you for as long as you want us to do that. But I think that's basically the bottom line. Is the normal assumption is, oh my goodness, as soon as you get lawyers involved, you don't even need to ask the question. You know, it's going to be more expensive. One of the reasons why our rate might actually be more cost beneficial to you is that the rate that our governmental rate that we charge our governmental clients is less than what lawyers charge to private clients by a significant amount. And while $250 an hour is not cheap, it's probably much cheaper than what you and I would experience if we went to a private attorney to seek services for divorce or labor or some other issue. So I hope that answers it.
Thank you, Paul. Mayor Flores.
Yeah, a couple of things here. How many staff members do we have right now? 10, 11?
When we're fully staffed, because we created a new position too, is 16.
16.
Yeah.
So I know that maybe in the last few months we have gone through some HR issues, but I don't know moving forward how many staff issues or HR issues that will arise that we need a full-time dedicated team to warrant $7,000 or more a month. So perhaps going with the legal, having the legal team by our side with maybe an internal person at handling the day-to-day. Now, do we want to add more to someone who has a current job, or do we go and seek someone else and add a sort of a specialist role with the backing of a of the legal team behind us? And then regarding the payroll system, I don't know that you're going to find a consultant that's going to also provide that technology or the software. Usually that's an add-on that most consultants that I know usually recommend a platform that they would prefer to work in, but that's always going to be an additional cost.
All right, Joe, I'm going to pipe in for a second and then I'll recognize Councilman Napoleon again. I'd hate to see us add on staff. I'm sure that we have for the routine administrative matters, whether it's someone being hired just to give them the right paperwork to make sure that they get everything processed right, or routine matters as far as filling out health forms or whatever, we could probably do that internally. I'm not sure we would really need to add anybody on at this point.
No, not a full-time staff person. Currently, we are hiring folks, and we're also, our legal counsel is doing a legal review and a compensation analysis of all of our positions. We do have an internal staff member on the finance team that has been assigned the responsibility, but also is being readjusted for that additional responsibility to handle basically posting job ads, being that point of communication through a TPA HR email, and benefits enrollment, kind of getting staff onboarded. But for example, in terms of, we recently offered a job to someone, and in terms of the negotiation or back and forth questions on benefits, our attorney was able to handle that phone call.
Who are they reporting to?
They report to Matthew.
Okay.
Yeah, so we absorb that into the finance team, the recruitment process, new hire orientation and onboarding, that we absorb that into finance.
All right.
But more significant kind of trainings would the legal team has offered HR staff to
All right. To I'm going to recognize my vice chair, and then I think we need to, you're done? Okay. I want to try and bring this back to the original question. Do we need to continue with the RFP, or should we suspend it and see if this is a adequate handling of this area? Councilman?
I just don't think that $7,000 a month number seems to make any kind of sense, because that's not, a small business can't afford $7,000 a month. So whatever information we must have gotten doesn't, either we're not understanding it, or doesn't, or they're give us bad information. This should probably cost somewhere like, you know, $1,500 a month for 10, 11 employees on an, as an outsource basis with whatever we need. So I'd like to see what the real numbers are, because for $12,000 a year, I think it makes sense to have someone who can do all these things versus the law firm is going to charge us on a per hour basis. I just think, I don't know where we got the information from, what that person gave us, but it just seems like the numbers don't make any sense from what I've experienced, and my extremely limited Google search just now tells me that number doesn't make any sense.
We felt that way too.
Do we have a consensus to continue on with the process, not to take away from what's happening right now? It seems to be adequately held as far as between the law office and the administrative processing here, but to continue with an RFP and get another bite at the apple. And again, if we find these numbers just to be ridiculous, just to continue as we are.
Since the RFP really wasn't satisfied, what I think we should do is let our attorneys' wives handle what they can handle, see what can be handled in-house, give it like a 6-month time frame and see if it's working properly and if it's, and what it's costing us. Cause then we will have a true and take the time that our staff is actually putting towards this, include that. So we know what the whole package would be. I hope I made sense with what I just said. And then in 6 months, see what we've done. And then we'll have an idea of what it really is costing us.
All right. My only thought is I'd like to see this a little cleaner, the way that the data is being captured and then being transferred into the payroll system. I hate to see this bifurcation or the separation between what's your time management system and your payroll system. And I don't know, again, like we've said before, it might be something as simple as a software that a law office would use, a small law office of, you know, half a dozen lawyers who each have to, every 10 minutes have to be able to identify what they're doing so it can be billed out. That would give us the kind of detail we're looking for. Right, Michael?
Right. That's 6 minutes.
I'll comment on that. I agree with, I like the recommendation from Commissioner Marino. Also in that time frame of 6 months, we can focus on the goal of getting the ultimate accounting and timekeeping system, and that request for services that we're working towards. So we'll have a better idea of, I think, a better picture at that point in time. Potentially maybe having either a peer or maybe legal counselor or someone also come in and work with finance and see if there's any efficiencies or best practices that we can incorporate in that process.
Sure. Do you have a budget item for this right now to incorporate the legal expenses that are being expended on HR?
We have a legal services budget. So it's because that's a somewhat of a large unknown, but some of the things we have out there, I have a couple of flexible points within my budget. I have a budget for legal services. I have money to accommodate both. Right now, it seems like it's okay. Is moving forward. I don't think we'll have a problem right now.
We budgeted extra amount in case because we have a lawsuit on hold with West Palm Beach. So we have a pretty big window. But if we near, or if in this next 6 months, if we see that we are using a lot, then we can revisit.
Well, but I would want to see the lawsuit with West Palm be separated from the legal that is attributed to HR. Mm-hmm. I think we need to keep those in different buckets at this point.
Yes.
They are, those services are separate, are billed under a separate invoice. All so right. It's easy to track what the litigation expense would be.
Okay, good.
All right. More points of interest or comments? I think we have a general consensus on that. Thank you, Matthew. All right. I'm just to clean this up because I'm looking at my little script here and I should have asked for a motion to approve the agenda. So can I have a motion? I have a motion by Commissioner Marino, seconded by Mayor Reed. All in favor, all opposed. Okay. You can amend the minutes.
Thank you.
I'll follow my script from now on.
That's okay.
All right. We are done discussing everything.
Director's report, yes, but we can move on to the action items.
Okay. I make a motion. We approve the minutes from the August 29th meeting.
I have a motion by Commissioner Marino, seconded by the mayor from Chelsea. The mayor from Chelsea. Palm Beach. The mayor from Chelsea. I think we should. All in favor, all opposed. Okay, that's approved. Let's move on to, we have a action item. So why don't you present the amended and restated TPA personal handbook?
Great. So I am going to present this item, but we do have Milton, who spoke earlier, and Paul on the phone, because they've really been the deep dive on our handbook. So I asked legal counsel to review and update our personnel handbook, and there was a memo in the agenda packet, but I'm going to give a highlight of the table that was included in the memo. Basically, they reviewed in detail the entire handbook, updated it for legal requirements, for best practices, and that's what is being presented today. So I'm going to kind of breeze through it, and if there are any questions, we do have them on the line. Okay. Oh. Too many clicks. Okay. So in the introduction, it used to be just kind of a welcome letter. They have provided more depth to that, added additional information about the handbook, and described the role of the executive director and the board, and just more of a description about who we are as an agency. Under general information, it clarified, so on the very far right corner is what's changed. So defined the board's authority in amending the handbook, and also defined the executive director's role in chief personnel administration and CFO's role in establishing accounting and payroll policies. Under TPA employment policies, they added some language to include for the Department of Labor for safe harbor policy that was not included in the handbook. So they added that. Also clarified tuition reimbursement. So we offered tuition reimbursement, but it didn't necessarily say that it needs to be related to your job here and that we will help with tuition reimbursement for a max of one degree at each level. So, we'll help with a bachelor's, with a master's, but to a certain extent as an agency. Continuing on, one of the items that is a change in the current handbook, we had that exempt employees, because exempt employees are so the current policy says that comp time can be earned by non-exempt and exempt employees. However, the law says that the non-exempt employees are not allowed to, basically you're not allowed to earn overtime if you're exempt. So it was flagged by our attorney saying that this is not really something that exempt employees are earning or logging comp time for extra additional hours work, that salary employees work a 40-hour week, and that's the norm. And so that's something that was refined in this handbook. Basically, previously, non-exempt and exempt employees were both able to earn comp time. But now it would be, if you're a salary employed, then you have to, if you have to work a little more, then you might have to flex time or use something like that instead of earning additional pay or bank time for that.
What's the breakdown of exempt to non-exempt?
Milton, do you want to chime in for the breakdown for exempt or non-exempt?
I'm just on the census. I'm just trying to figure out what percentage of our employees here are exempt here? And what are non-exempt. Yeah.
Oh, Valerie can answer that.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So currently we have a couple administrative positions that are non-exempt, and our labor team is looking at, in reviewing everyone's job descriptions for legality and also compensation analysis. They're confirming that, but most people are exempt. I don't know if Milton, if you want to add into that.
Milton, yes, I mean, correct. Executive assistant, are those are exempt positions?
We are actually looking at every position just to make sure that no one's misclassified. But as Ms. Nielsen said, the vast majority of the workforce there, they're exempt, they're salaried, with a couple of exceptions. We might be able to maybe label someone else non-exempt, maybe one additional person, but for the most part, most of the employees that work for the agency, they're exempt. You know, they are administrative employees, they have a lot of discretion, they have a lot of independent judgment, so they should be exempt.
Okay.
That being said, so that's something that they flagged as a recommended change, and also something that we're confirming with the feds, but we haven't, our peer MPOs don't offer it, so we're updating that. That being said, for anyone who had any comp time that was exempt, because in the current handbook, it says that employees will be paid out any comp time, basically 1 hour for an hour at time of termination. Legal has interpreted that as if that benefit or vested benefit is terminating, that's an opportunity to pay out because it's no longer going to be continued. It would be paid out if you have any balance.
So what is the suggestion on exempt employees that have accumulated comp time? We're going to just let it sit there and...
We would, the recommendation and interpretation from legal would be to pay them out since that benefit or that those terms will be changing. So if you have any stored, it would be like a payout for that time.
Payout, or could it be converted to vacation time?
We do have a cap for vacation time. We followed the same policy as when we were at the county of 400 hours. So it's not a liability for the agency if you continue to accrue and accrue. So that could be a disadvantage to someone if they're already at that, very near that cap, because they can't add additional time to it.
Right.
So. Okay.
Milton, does this restrict the executive director from being able to do something? Let's say we have a hurricane and the office is closed, but she needs some people to come in for a project that needs to be finished. Does that mean that she can't do anything to reward those employees for the above and beyond?
I'll jump in on the hurricane example. So we do have a COOP, a continuing operations and procedures manual. And for this recent hurricane that happened, if we're in an extreme situation where there's no power or there's no internet or whatnot, no one can do anything, we're not the type of agency that's really going out and having to provide services to the community. We're a planning agency. So we do have the capability and the setup to be able to work from home. So we do have, so if we are working from home, people can continue to work from home and not be interrupted. If we're absolutely closed, then that would be administrative leave pay. But Milton, I'll let you jump in if you want to answer.
No, that's a good question. So, you know, because we're striking the whole benefit from the handbook, that won't be available going forward for Ms. Nielsen to use to reward employees. There are other items or fringe benefits in the contract that she would be able to utilize, though. As I indicated, there's a flex time. Of course, she can reward someone extra compensation with a bonus program if she wanted to. So there are other, you know, mechanisms that she has, but comp time would not be one of them.
Okay.
The idea is if someone has to work or there's a required event outside of work hours that you would, and you're exempt, that you would have pre-approval. I have to work this weekend event or this evening meeting, and then you would flex time after on a different day. You leave earlier or whatnot. So I'm just trying to go over the table that was in the memo provided by in the backup. So some other changes included that the agency shouldn't pay an employee placed on administrative leave under certain circumstances. For example, they're pending a criminal charge and they can't come to work. An agency that we're not going to pay an employee who is absent from work, who is participating in some sort of litigation unrelated to the job. So it was a little ambiguous before, so it provided some clarity on that.
As opposed to jury duty?
Jury duty is paid as admin leave. But okay. If you're in your own personal lawsuit that you have to leave and do things, we're not going to give you admin leave for that. It provides some clarification on conference leave time. Ensure that the conference is directly related to the position and it's actually a value to the agency if we're paying for it. Paid parental leave, we had adopted that after the county adopted the 6 weeks of paid parental leave. But basically it was, we can provide up to 6 weeks, but if someone shows up at work or they do anything for work, then your paid parental leave is done. So this provides a little more flexibility in the sense of, yes, it's 6 weeks, but if for some reason you had to come and attend a meeting one of those days that you were able to, then we can extend a day of your six weeks. And then one of the things that was identified, it's actually the next item, but the personnel handbook is for TPA employees. And so in there we mentioned TPA board travel and that sort of approval, which didn't really belong in there. So we're putting that into the operating procedures, and that's the next item on our agenda, but it was a cleanup of that as well. So there was also there's a section 3, and there was also legal updates to that section. Legal language provided, for example, we didn't have a list of what drugs you shouldn't be on and other things like that. So thank you to our TPA General Counsel for having that deep dive into our updating that. So that's the general kind of overview of this update to the handbook. I know they're on the line if there's any other questions, but
okay. Any questions, or do I have a motion to recommend approval? Second. I have a motion by Mayor Flores. I have a second by Commissioner Marino. Seeing no further discussion, we are unanimous in moving this now to the full board.
No discussion, just got great catches though on their parts. Those are definitely places where we could have had hiccups, especially the clarification on tuition and safe harbor.
Okay, next item.
So the next item is an update to the operating procedures, and it's basically what I just mentioned. Currently, it was in the employee handbook that the TPA chair would approve any travel for board members. Basically, this exact language that underlined is from the employee handbook, now moved under the operating procedures for the board and committees. And it says that the chair will approve any travel for board members, other appointed officials, anybody basically that the TPA wants to fund travel for.
All right, this brings up an interesting question, and I'll propose it to the four of you. The chair approves his own expenses. So I know. So I said to Valerie, basically, I can't see a problem with that. At some point, someone is at the top of the food chain. So the chair of the agency is going to be approving his or her own expenses. Obviously, if there's a problem, I would expect that Mr. Kama would bring that to the attention of the board at the next meeting. that there was a variance with the travel policy or whatever the disbursement was for. But I don't see that we can tie up that approval and wait for another board meeting to get a full board approval on that. So I'm going to see if you concur with me, Mayor.
I do concur. I understand what you're saying. And I just, in my experience traveling with the TPA, the forms are thorough. There's no doubt about it, especially like what we're allowed for breakfast or lunch or things like that. But this most recent example where we had to cancel a trip because of the hurricane, Matthew and I spoke when I scheduled my ticket and I said, you know, hey, maybe I should make this refundable just in case. And it was an extra like $35 or it was negligible difference to do that, which I'm so glad I did because now I'm not, and you're not on the hook for a $500 ticket because it just went poof. And same for my reservation for my hotel. I had a window that I was aware of that I could cancel it. So the TPA and my personal self did not lose any money doing that, but we don't really have that written as policy anywhere. And so that if we're going to talk about approval and things like that, that might be something we need to start saying is like, you know, if it's a trip where if we're driving to Miami, that's obviously we're not going to need to worry about it. But if we're flying somewhere, it needs to be, you know, not first class. It needs to be, you know, have a refundable policy or whatever you guys think in your experience works well so that we don't wind up in a situation where we're on the hook for more money than we should be.
Definitely. And I brought that up also to our legal counsel. They said that should be a policy in the guidance that we do have, because we do have to follow strict federal guidance on our travel that we get reimbursed for. So even though the chair might say, I approve this board member to go to the Revolution Conference, the board member still has to register, pay, follow the steps in the form that the federal government asks us to do to be able to be reimbursed. So that's still, you have to follow that process. In those steps, if we don't already, we can say, please book a refundable, but pay for the travel insurance when you're booking your travel. So that would be something we can include in that form.
Do we want to have a hard and fast rule? I mean, we may find that the fare for refundable is twice as much as the non-refundable. And the question is, do we take the chance that it might be canceled, but realize that it would take two to...
And I think that it's more so, it's not, I know that the fares are usually way higher if you're buying a refundable ticket. This is more just buying the $30 travel insurance. So if something happens, you're sick, disaster. This time for the peer exchange, the airlines were all giving travel. Well, I had an economy ticket, but they gave me until end of April to use it, mm-hmm. like the credit, because there was a natural disaster. But I think as a policy and the instructions, we can say pay the extra $30 or whatever it is for the travel insurance in case something comes up and you can't make it.
Any more thoughts? I mean, I hate to have a hard and fast rule. I think we have to have a little bit of subjective, thoughts on this. Any thoughts, Mr. Controller? Not yet. Push it again.
I think we're going to get there. Can you hear me?
No. There you go.
There it goes. So one option is either, there's two roads there. Authorize it, either Valerie or someone to say, okay, we can reimburse you in the case of a flight that you have to cancel, or to put the onus on the traveler and say, if you buy a non-refundable ticket and you have to cancel, you're going to have to eat it. Again, I'm not trying to put that.
No one's going to do a non-refundable. They're just going to say, well, it's not on, if it's going to be someone, it's going to be the TPA that's going to pay for it.
Sure. I think there were two roads that I can see.
The clarifying point, though, when we talk about refundable, because you can buy the main class and the different levels and fully refundable ticket, but if you buy a normal ticket and you just pay for the insurance, which means something happened, you had a death in your family, you couldn't make it anymore, that kind of thing, that you'll get your monies back for that ticket.
Is there insurance on those kind of seats or those kind of tickets? I didn't know if there were or not.
Yeah, when usually you check out, limited. They ask
it's usually for... very limited what you can get out of really? A ticket on mm-hmm. for the insurance. You're better off pricing out the refundable when you can just cancel at the last minute. That's a better deal, especially if it's as cheap as that was.
All right, Milton, time for you to pipe in. What is some of our peers do in this situation?
As far as travel?
Yeah, as far as company reimbursed travel in the situation that a travel is canceled because either they got sick or there's some, the conference got canceled, or, you know, weather creates a problem for some reason or other, they don't travel. And so we have a situation now that if they took a non-refundable ticket, then the agency is going to basically be paying for something that is not for travel. It's just for a ticket that's no good anymore.
Yeah, what some agencies are doing is requiring the purchase of this insurance that some of these companies are saying you should purchase. So that's the only thing I'm really seeing. And it really just depends on, you know, how strong that insurance is. For example, as you know, airlines have their own insurance policy. But yes, that's what I'm seeing, is that as part of the signing up for a particular conference or leave, that you would also purchase that insurance.
So would you recommend we incorporate that into this travel approval policy to give notice that if they're going to get a non-refundable ticket, that they should pair it with a purchase of travel insurance?
Yes, it can either be in the body of this document or some sort of standalone instruction document. But yes, it should be written down somewhere, that requirement.
Mayor?
I would recommend that it's in the instructions, because we have the detailed purchase your ticket, show us a comparison of flights, the things that the federal government's asking us for federally funded or reimbursed travel. So in there,
do you see a problem getting reimbursement in a situation where the travel didn't occur, but it was for justified reasons?
To be honest, I'm not sure, because I haven't had that occasion where a traveler just, where they didn't go, and then the TPA has now paid some expense and they can't get back.
We'd likely have to pay for it out of local funds, because the federal government, let's say a board member says, yeah, I'd like to go to that peer exchange or to that conference. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, I booked my ticket, and at the last minute they decided that they have something else, so they can't go. But it's really just because they don't, at a last minute change. It's really on, if they cancel their flight, they're going to get the American Airlines credit in their account or whatever they're doing. It's kind of like, you know, back on them, versus the federal government's not going to say this trip didn't occur. You didn't actually go on it, so we're not going to pay you and reimburse you for something you didn't do. So then if we were to pay for them, it would have to be out of our local funds that don't have those strings.
That's generally what I would do.
So there is a pile, or there is a place where you can get that money from to reimburse the agency for that expense. It wouldn't be an expense that you have to go back to the board member and say, I need you to give us the money back because I can't reconcile my books now.
Just to clarify on that, this is the main reason that we don't book travel for board members, because you have very challenging schedules as it is. So we don't pay for your expense up front. So it wouldn't be us going back and getting it from you. It's that we didn't give you the money in the first place. When you said, hey, I had a flight and I had a board meeting that came up that was critical, I could not miss, and I couldn't go. So I bought $300 for a flight. And at which point it puts us to making a decision. Well, I'm not going to take that to the feds. We would use, you know, local funds. We would have a discussion internally. Is that appropriate if you guys approve that?
So that's going to be for the board chair to make the decision on that.
You approve the other travel. So I think that's kind of where that discussion is. Where do we have, who has the discretion to say that's an acceptable expense?
Right.
So what I said then is kind of moot. Then we don't really need a policy on it because it's on us. So perhaps the policy needs to be, if you're on the board and you plan to go on one of these trips, do you realize you may need to absorb the costs if you decide not to go? Because that might just be some clarity people don't know, because as what just happened with this recent peer exchange changing, at the very beginning of it, we were thinking of changing it, mostly because we were worried about getting home, but we didn't know whether or not the airports would be closed or not. So there's a good chance all the flights could have come and gone, just depending on a little wobble in the storm, right? So some of us were choosing to possibly stay, and some of us were choosing to possibly go either way. And so if those who decided to stay and the airports had stayed open, they would then be financially responsible for what they booked, which is fine, which is fair.
Because I was canceling my trip before this got canceled. And I figured if I have to eat my ticket, I eat my ticket.
So maybe
go. So that's on me.
So yeah, exactly. And I think that's totally fine. So we don't necessarily need a policy about it, but just clarity that it's obviously your responsibility if
we can reimburse the trip insurance. I think that's something that we can put in there to say, in case something does happen, you know.
That'll be a reimbursable.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. All right. All right. And again, back to the original thought that I threw on the table, you're all comfortable with the idea that the board chair will have the authority to approve his or her own expenses. And if there is something that is worrying our CFO, he will be duty bound to bring it before the board at its next meeting.
Okay.
Okay.
Just don't book like a, you know, luxury yacht to take you to lunch.
Damn it. Hey,
we do
I
have
didn't
rules.
Say no private place. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So that's the change to the operating procedures.
I'll look for a motion. I have a motion by Commissioner Marino, seconded by the mayor. All in favor, all opposed. Show it is approved unanimously. Recommended to the full board. Okay.
Great. We have one more item. We usually bring this in December, but surprisingly, we're already... most people I've talked to, including myself, already getting booked for things into 2023. So we want to make sure that our board has the dates on the calendar. So we've put together meeting dates for 2023. The slide will change.
Did you check these against BCC and holidays?
So normally...
meetings?
Yes. So normally our governing board, which is the first row on the top, we don't have meetings in January, August, or November. We meet the third Thursday of the month at 9 a.m. So none of that changed. However, to avoid conflicts, we didn't have conflicts on for the board, but we did have for the Vision Zero Advisory Committee. We moved things. And then also in October, we had to shift things because FDOT gave us a very small window that we need to bring to the, we would like to bring to the committees as well. Committees and board are the citizens report, which is basically the draft tentative work program. And we have to have that approved. And it was a very tight window. So we moved things, we scrunched things into October. So it would actually be the fourth Thursday versus the third.
October 26th is a huge conflict with the county because we have a zoning hearing that day. So that would be what, four of us wouldn't be there. So that could be an issue.
The 26th.
This year?
Or next year. 23, yeah. So
we have our calendar for next year.
This is the draft dates that we wanted to run by you guys. So make sure there aren't any conflicts.
So for the 26th, we could flag that one to possibly relocate the date on that one.
Yeah, we could maybe send before the agenda goes out, we could send a doodle poll potentially for that week and see if there's a better day.
October 26th isn't going to work because it's a zoning meeting.
Yeah, so another day. Basically, we have a two-week window to bring it to the committees and board. Otherwise, we don't bring it to the committees and we just bring it to the board and we stay with October 19th date and we can bring it to them after. But we try to bring things to them first so that they get to opine. And
if the county can't be there on the 26th, can't we leave that blank for now and send out a doodle poll to the entire board before the next board meeting? And then whatever they vote on, put that date in there.
Yeah. I mean, we can bring this to the next board meeting. And between now and when we send out the agenda, the board meeting's October 20th, the agenda is going to go out next week, Thursday. So we could tomorrow send a doodle poll, say we're looking out into 2023. We're trying to find a date during this week. to try to bring that. Again, the other alternatives to stay with the board schedule, and then we just bring that to the advisory committees after the fact.
Right. MPOEC is also October 26th, and that's a definite no then for a lot of us that are sitting here.
For 23?
For 23. Oh. I've already got there.
All right, so okay. The 26th is not working.
Is there a preference to bring it after the fact to the advisory committees and just not enter, it's basically FDOT's work program.
Can't bring it to them in September?
No, because they're going to give it to us right before that week of the 18th, and then they need it back by the November 2nd. So it's like we're really, it's a statewide thing, and that we have 2 weeks to kind of turn around.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say yep.
Yeah, it's going to have to go in reverse order, unfortunately.
Okay. So we can keep it for October 19th.
Yeah.
And then bring it to them as more of an information item afterwards.
Yeah, I guess that's the way it's going to. Unfortunately, I don't see another way around it.
Yeah.
All right, you double check. There's no other.
Well, yeah, we'll confirm that. But my understanding is it needs to be adopted by our board. So.
All right. And did you, I mean, we have other reports that we have to approve so that they. The up and.
Yeah. All those dates are should be good. Yeah.
Okay.
December is not the third Thursday of the month because of the holiday. So that's pretty normal. We usually do it on the second Thursday. Other than that, there weren't any other conflicts for the governing board meeting that we saw.
All right.
But
it's Hanukkah, but that's okay.
What?
December 14th, but it's okay. It's okay. Hanukkah's not one of those that we all stay home. We just light a candle.
Okay, so we're going to revert back. We're going to confirm, but I'm pretty sure we'll revert back to the normal October board meeting,
right.
And then we'll bring a normal committee meetings that month, and we'll just bring that item to the following month, the following opportunity. We'll confirm that. And between now and our board meeting, if there's anything else that's flagged, the major conflict.
All right. So I'm going to look for a motion to approve the tentative schedule for the TPA meetings for 2023. Mayor Flores has made a motion. Made the motion. Mayor Reed has seconded it. All in favor? All opposed? Show it is approved.
For clarification, with that modification for October.
With the modification back to the 19th for the October meeting.
Okay.
All right. Good. All right. We are pretty much on schedule here. Any other information items we need?
Thank you, staff, for pulling that up a little sooner than usual. I was getting so many calendar things that I started to get nervous for 23 already.
All right. Speaking of dates, is everybody okay with December 5th for our next meeting?
Sure.
All right. Then we stand adjourned. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.